The Lord be with you. You're listening to a podcast from the teaching ministry of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community. For more multimedia content or to get more information, go to www.epiclesis.org. Now, here's Pastor Chris.
I'd like you to take your Bibles, please, and we will eventually end up in the gospel reading for today, which is printed there for you. There are some other passages that are also printed there, and I would encourage you to take a look at them and tease out some of the themes that no doubt we will cover today as we think about our King Jesus. It is Christ the King Sunday, and just this past week, unless you, like increasing numbers of us, completely turn off the news or social media or cut off contact to any sort of word from the outside world, you've heard things about kings and princes and presidents and queens and the law and senators and trials and governors and lawlessness and the environment, hopelessness, homelessness, trauma, slavery, trafficking, sin, despair, addiction, death. Do you feel like the world is broken? Do you feel the shadows deepen? Do you sense that all creation is groaning? And do you cry out, who can possibly save us from this? A lot of people are doing that in their own way. And they look to the highest locus, L-O-C-U-S, in their own thinking about, and it reveals a lot, doesn't it, about who or what it is that can save them. You learn a lot about somebody by discovering who it is or what it is they look to for salvation. Because for a lot of people, it's environmental something or other, or legislation, or politics, or a particular party, or something like that. I tell you today, what we really need is a king. What we really need is a king. And I want to show you something in today's gospel reading. And it's in Luke, and I want you to turn there. Perhaps you're already there. And the pericope of Scripture, at least in your order of service, talks about Luke 23 starting at 32. But I'd like to back up a little bit and look even at the beginning of the chapter. The setting is this. Let me paint the picture for you. It is the crucifixion and the events surrounding the crucifixion. And I want to paint a picture for you, or at least remind you of some of the goings on in and around the crucifixion. And today we're going to look at two people, two distinct individuals in and around the crucifixion, and we're going to see who they looked to for salvation. So let me do a little bit of reading, and you might want to mark a couple of places. We will bounce around a bit to get a more full story. So again, it's the story of the crucifixion and two very different characters. And by the way, these two different characters had two really different ideas about the kingship of Jesus. Chapter 23. Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. We're talking about Jesus. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ, a king." Look at verse number 3. So Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus replies, "Yes." "Yes, it is as you say." And then what happens afterwards is that they get together and this causes a stir and they start to talk. Because as you can imagine, there's lots of kerfuffle over this. Can I say kerfuffle? Because among other things, they start to have a discussion about whose jurisdiction does this fall under? We were talking earlier in our Heidelberg Catechism about governance and jurisdiction and how all of it falls under the kingship, the lordship of Jesus Christ. And so now, in a worldly way, they're asking some similar things. Verse number 6 and following, Pilate is asking if this man is a Galilean. And so we better send him off to Herod because he falls under Herod's jurisdiction. I think this is important for a little bit later in the story. By the way, it says in verse 8 that when Herod finally sees Jesus, he is pleased because for a long time he had been wanting to see him. When we went to the Holy Land last fall, and we did not get to go down into Bethlehem, it wasn't in the itinerary, it is in a Palestinian-controlled area, and we just didn't make those connections this particular time. But we were on the hillsides around Bethlehem, and in the distance, this just blows my mind. It's a big connection for me, maybe not for you. But in the distance from Bethlehem, you can see Herodium. Herodium is this giant man-made mountain that Herod made for his own entombment, a monument to himself. And it would have been started very early on and would have been visible at the time that Jesus is born. Does that just blow you away, or is it just me? So here's this monument to self, and finally these two see each other face to face. Well, eventually, they mock Jesus, Herod's soldiers do, and they talk to him, and they mock him, and they put a robe on him, mocking his, quote, kingship, and then they send him back to Pilate. Now, I want you to take a look at another little spot that fills in a little bit more of the story. It is in the gospel, I marked it, of Mark. Would you turn to Mark's gospel, the 15th chapter? We learn a little bit more about the mocking and what takes place and what is said. And I think particularly in light of our look at Pilate and Christ the King Sunday, it's really interesting. Mark's Gospel, chapter 15. First, here's this place where Pilate asks Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Mark chapter 15, verse 2. "Are you the king of the Jews?" asked Pilate. "Yes, it is as you say." Later on, Pilate asks the crowd in verse 9, "Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" Notice that Pilate says, "the king of the Jews." Knowing it was out of envy that the chief priests had handed Jesus over to them. And they stir up the crowd and say, what? You know what? Give us Barabbas. Verse number 12, "What shall I do then with the one you call the king of the Jews?" Interesting change of language. Not quite sure what to make of that, although I have an idea for you here in a minute. Well, they say, "Crucify him." Later on, the soldiers mock Jesus. Skip over to verse number 18, would you, in the same chapter. And they begin to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews." There they use the title. Again, they struck him on the head with a staff. By the way, a symbol of authority. They struck him on the head with a staff, and they spit on him. And falling on their knees, they paid homage to him, mocking him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. Look over at verse 31. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Christ," or HaMashiach, "let this anointed one," let this Christ, this King of Israel, "come down from the cross that we may see and believe." Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. I got to thinking that there's one other place that Pilate talks about this title, King of the Jews, and you can find it in John's Gospel. Would you turn over there with me, please, to John chapter 19? And we learn a little bit more about Pilate and his role in all of this, and maybe gain a little bit of insight into what he thought about this business of Jesus being called King of the Jews. John 19, and I'm at verse number 19. So 19. Are you there? Pilate had a notice prepared and fastened to the cross. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." Many of the Jews read this sign, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city, and the sign was written in Aramaic, Latin, and Greek. The chief priests of the Jews protested to Pilate, "Do not write the King of the Jews, but that this man claimed to be the King of the Jews." Now stop there for just a second. Let's get all the details. This just absolutely fascinates me. Pilate says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to get a sign, and you're going to put Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. And you're going to do it in three different languages. Got to make sure it gets on the right cross. And you're going to put it there, and you're going to take the effort to make sure that we get this labeled correctly. I think that's interesting. But then the chief priest, who already got what they want, come back to him now after the fact and say, "We want something else, and that wasn't good enough, and we would like to massage the message. We would like to fiddle with," can I say fiddle? "We'd like to fiddle with what you have said. The propaganda isn't quite right. Don't you write the King of the Jews, but that this man claimed to be the King of the Jews." Verse 22, Pilate answered, "What I have written, I have written." Really interesting. Now, have you ever wondered about why Pilate did what he did? Have you ever wondered about that? By the way, there is a tradition in some places that says, it's extra biblical, that Pilate somehow at some point became a Christian, and there's just absolutely no evidence for that. He was the fourth or fifth governor of Judea. He eventually is forced out. Evidently, he was one who was a little bit always afraid of something being stirred up against him and that the Romans would come and toss him out. And in fact, that's exactly what happened just a few short years later. He was always getting into little entanglements with the Jews, and evidently the leaders had some hold over him. If they stirred up enough stuff, they could cause enough trouble. In this particular case, he says, "I have written what I have written." Have you ever thought about why? I think I know, although it's just a guess. I'll tell you about it in just a minute. I want you to contrast Pilate with somebody else in the story. So go back, if you would, to Luke, where we were reading earlier. And this time, we'll start at verse 36. We've seen Pilate, and we've seen his response to the King of the Jews. Now I want to show you somebody else's response. Verse 36, "The soldiers also came and mocked him. They offered him wine vinegar and said, 'If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself.'" Have you noticed in the story that a lot of people are throwing around the term King of the Jews? A lot of people are using it. A lot of people are saying it. Wonder what they mean. Could there be a lot of different meanings? And what does it mean to throw around that term? Verse 38, "There was a written notice above him which read, 'This is the King of the Jews.'" We read about that in John's gospel. Now, listen to this. Verse 39, "One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. 'Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us.'" Imagine the scene. It has to be bloody. It has to be awful. It has to be one of the worst possible things that you could see in your lifetime. It was probably also not unusual to see that. And here in the midst of this terrible scene, to make matters worse, someone right next to you, while you are being tortured, is torturing you with their words. I'm going to say that again. You're being tortured, and the people around you who are also being tortured are torturing you with their words. Can you imagine? I was watching a movie the other night about a condemned person, and this was France back in the day. I don't remember, it was a historical drama. And the person is led to the guillotine, and they are marched up on the scaffold. And before they are put to death, the people are gathered like it was a holiday. And they have brought their lunch and their picnics and the family because they're coming to see a spectacle. And the ladies bring their handkerchiefs because they're going to dip it in the blood. You've heard these stories, right? As a keepsake, as a souvenir of the event. I don't know whether that kind of thing happened in this day, but the Romans did publicly crucify to send a message to everybody else. It's a very public event. In the case of the movie, the people in the crowd were hurling, I love that word there, hurling insults to the person. Can you imagine? You're being led to your death, and the last thing you hear on this earth is someone insulting you. That's one of the thieves, verse 40, but the other criminal rebuked him. Don't you fear God? Don't you fear God? He said, since you are under the same sentence, we are punished justly, for we are getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong. This man has done nothing wrong. Now look what happens in the space between verse 41 and verse 42. Have you ever seen faith spark and grow before your eyes? Have you ever seen miraculous transformation in a tiny little spot right in front of you? Have you ever seen, I'm getting goosebumps, have you ever seen redemption and recreation right before your eyes? It happens right here. But this man has done nothing wrong. Verse 42, then he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Oh my goodness. Do you see what's happened? Do you sense the transformation? Do you get what just occurred? Jesus, he knows his name. Remember, we'll come back to that. You should circle it. Remember me. I know who I am in light of you. Remember me when you, who are more than a man, come into your, it belongs to you, kingdom, for you are a king. In one little place, we see an amazing transformation and a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful spark of faith ignite. The word remember, you should look it up. In this particular place, it's not the Greek word anamnesis that we talk a lot about here, but it has the same kind of meaning. In biblical times, the word remember was a lot more than just, oh, think about the time we did this. Like today, would you think about the time that you did the Thanksgiving dinner, but the turkey got messed up, so instead you went to Kentucky Fried Chicken? Did that happen to anyone ever? That's not the kind of memory the Bible talks about when it talks about remembering. In the Bible, memory is bringing something from the past into the present with such force that it does not lose any of its power. It's a past event with a present reality, anamnesis. That's what happens at table. Jesus is standing among us in his risen power. That's the kind of memory here. Listen, when the thief says, remember me when you come into your kingdom, he's not saying, hey, on the other side, whatever that looks like, please think fondly back on our day here that we hung together on the cross. That's not what he's saying. Think about that time that we were on Golgotha being crucified. No, no. In this particular case, catch this. You're about to get goosebumps. In this particular case, it's an active word that means to be engaged, to be betrothed. It's a covenantal word that hearkens to marriage. Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. I'm placing all of my faith in you. Here is the difference between Pilate and the thief. I told you that I was going to tell you what my guess was about why Pilate did the thing with the title. I think Pilate did it to point to his own sovereignty. I think Pilate did it to say, I have jurisdiction here. So I'm going to stick this thing up here just to remind you that I have the power to do that. So I'll call you whatever I need to in order for it to reflect on me. I'm going to do this for me. Pilate, here's the point. Pilate ascribed to Jesus the title, but not the worth. And we'll say that again. Pilate ascribed to him the title, but not the worth. Why? To ascribe the worth to himself. The thief ascribed to him the title and the worth. Because not every king can remember you after death. Today is Christ the King Sunday. And this past week, beloved, my heart has been so heavy, variety of reasons. And I've heard just in one block of television and news stuff about kings and princes and sex trafficking and presidents and trials and lawlessness and governors and environment and trauma and despair and death and addiction and homelessness. And I'll tell you what, we need a king. We need a king. But not an earthly one.
You've been listening to a podcast from Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community. If you'd like to learn more about ancient future faith or worship at Epiclesis, visit us on the web at www.epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you.